Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. December 7th marks the 76th anniversary of the Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, which President Roosevelt famously called a day that will live in infamy. It was one of the most stunning events in American history for many reasons, not the least of which was that, like 9/11, it revealed how vulnerable we were to an enemy with a ferocious appetite for destroying the American way of life and our grip on global power. How could the buildup to such a massive attack have gone completely unnoticed by U.S. military and intelligence forces? How could we have left so much of the Pacific Fleet unsecured at Pearl? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Toomey answers those questions and more in his book Countdown to Pearl Harbor, The 12 Days to the Attack. At the same time, he gives readers vivid portraits of the men and women in the United States and Japan who were key players in the run-up to the infamous attack. We interviewed Toomey last December when his book was first published. The paperback edition has just been released. Steve Toomey, welcome to Two-Way Street. It's a pleasure to be able to discuss your book, Countdown to Pearl Harbor, The 12 Days of the Attack.
Thank you for inviting me.
You say something in your book that is a good starting point. You say there had never been anything remotely like it, meaning the attack, in the history of naval warfare. The scale of the attack, the number of planes involved, the number of ships involved was monumental. Yes?
It was. The aircraft carrier, which was the heart of the Japanese attack, was a relatively new weapon in world history. There had been none in World War I to speak of. And so the Japanese were early adopters of the aircraft carrier as a weapon of the future, far ahead of us. And they brought six of them to the waters off Hawaii, and no one had ever put that many into a group before to conduct an attack.
Yeah, you point out there were 353 Japanese warplanes. And that was just, you say, 38 years after the invention of flight itself.
That's right. The airplane was about to dominate naval and land warfare. It had certainly played a great role in World War I, but it was only in the coming Second World War that people realized the full potential of the airplane. And it was the new king of the battlefield.
And we're going to talk about that, including the fact that even some in Japanese military leadership positions weren't certain that the aircraft carrier should, in fact, play the kind of role it eventually did. But we'll get to that. If you don't mind, I'd love to start really at the end of your story, because your book is told in such an exciting and compelling way. Sadly, we know the ending. 2,500 Americans killed at Pearl Harbor. So I don't think if we start at the end, we're revealing too much. Who is Husband Kimmel?
Husband Kimmel was the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet. He had been the commander since February of 1941. He was on the youngish side to be the commander-in-chief of the principal naval force of the United States. His record had been spotless. As far back as the early 1930s, someone reviewed his, gave him a personnel report and said he was a humdinger. He was universally respected for his relentless determination to make the fleet ready for the war he knew was coming. They all knew was coming. A little bit myopic in his focus sometimes. He was too wedded to knowing every single detail under his command. But he was someone in whom a lot of people thought they could put their faith as the country was about to go to war.
And yet, through a series of mistakes, some made by him, others misunderstandings of the wording of messages that were sent to him as commander of the fleet, and a variety of other circumstances, he found himself on December 7th, 1941, being taken completely by surprise by this attack. And you have a very moving passage in your book about that. I'd love it if you'd share it with us.
Sure. I probably should set up one thing. He was at home on the morning of December 7th. He lived in brand new quarters that had been built especially for the commander-in-chief. His family was not there because he felt having his wife in Hawaii would complicate his ability to do his job. So he was alone in this big house when the phone rang. This is shortly before 8 a.m., and he was informed that an attack appeared to be underway. Now, his house sits on a small bluff, actually an extinct volcano, that overlooks Pearl Harbor. You can see it. The house is still there. You can see the harbor from his house. So with that set up. His uniform not yet buttoned, the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet stepped out of his new home and into his yard. Aircraft were descending, climbing, darting, red balls visible on every wing. All residents of Oahu were habituated to military planes overhead, but only their own, the Army's and the Navy's. And for the rest of their lives, they would speak of the shock of these alien red spheres, the improbability of it, the Japanese flying over the United States of America. Drawn by the crescendoing cacophony, Captain John Earl's wife emerged from her home next door to Kimmel's and joined him in the yard, two helpless witnesses to what the Admiral understood instinctively was budding catastrophe. To Grace Earl, he seemed transfixed, incredulous, his face as white as the uniform he wore. Even at some distance, Kimmel could see that one of his battleships had already begun to tip. His Buick pulled up. The driver, Edgar Nebel, had come unbidden. Kimmel dived in as someone else, perhaps another officer he would not remember, leaped aboard, and they roared off to fleet headquarters a few minutes away. Perhaps before they left, perhaps as they raced, but a few minutes past eight, a terrifying end-of-days detonation reverberated across the harbor and beyond. A bomb had plunged into the forward magazine of the Arizona, and she exploded and disappeared in a mountain of boiling, bluish-purple smoke that reached 1,000 feet. Pieces of her rained down on nearby ships and Ford Island.
That's Steve Toomey reading from his new book, Countdown to Pearl Harbor. The Arizona, of course, has become the centerpiece of the memorial that exists at Pearl Harbor to remember the day that lived in infamy, as FDR described it. Can you imagine putting yourself in husband Kimmel's shoes that morning?
Of course, I don't think any of us can because we hadn't had the career he had had prior to that moment. But also, we hadn't been making all the decisions he had been making. And at that moment, everything he assumed made military logic, was logically military, was being blown up before his eyes. It didn't make sense to him that the Japanese would try this attack. And all the decisions he had been making, the assumptions he had made, had been proven wrong right then and right there. And he knew the fate that befalls those who are in command at a moment of disaster. He knew he was going to be relieved, as he was within about 2 weeks.
Before we leave him, what happened to him after he was relieved of his command?
He was quickly pinpointed or scapegoated, choose your word, as the reason for the failure of the fleet to be ready. He never served again in any post, spent the war as a civilian working for a dry dock company in New York City. And for the rest of his life, he tried to clear his name to say that it wasn't his fault, that information had been kept from him. And he argued that others, particularly in Washington, were to blame for what happened. He wrote a book trying to clear his name. His family to this day is still fighting that fight to get Congress and the president to relieve him of the burden of Pearl Harbor.
You know, as long as we're talking about Kimmel, one of the things that you do focus on these final 12 days before the actual attack, And you pay particular attention to two communiques that came from Washington, from Naval Command, that Kimmel received. The first one was a war warning. That sentence was in the cable, correct?
Yes.
And what date was that?
That was November 27th. If you don't know much about Pearl Harbor, to read that sentence for the first time, as it was for me, is very startling. To think that Pearl Harbor had been warned 10 days before the attack that war was coming. The problem with that message, which came from the Navy Department, is that the first sentence was highly dramatic and quite startling to everyone who read it.
Do you remember it verbatim by any chance?
Yes, I think I know it's 9 words. This dispatch is to be considered a war warning. Two things about it. It didn't only go to the Pacific Fleet. It went to all American naval commands in the Pacific, which at that time included the Philippines. We owned the Philippines then, and also included the Panama Canal, which we owned then. The second thing about the message is that that wasn't the only sentence. It was followed immediately by speculation as to where the Japanese were going to attack. And it mentioned possibly the Philippines, possibly the Dutch East Indies, possibly the British port of Singapore, and other places. And Kimmel and his high-ranking officers read that message and noticed that Hawaii was not among the things mentioned. And they concluded that, therefore, the message did not apply directly to them. They were not about to be attacked. That wasn't Washington's intent. They wanted the first sentence to be an alarm to everybody. But a lesson here is, if you're going to write something, try to write it and then read it as a recipient might, so that possible other meanings are not missed in your wording. And so Pearl Harbor did not go on to any kind of an alert after that message.
Well, what compounded the problem, perhaps the lack of specificity or more clarity in the actual communique, was the fact that Harold Stark, who was in what position?
Chief of Naval Operations.
Chief of Naval Operations. And he was a leader who believed in letting his command team act on their own to take care of situations that he pointed out to them. So when Stark saw that message go out to Kimmel, he trusted that Kimmel would know that there were actions that must be taken in light of this warning, right?
Absolutely. It wasn't necessarily just Stark's philosophy, although he was a prime proponent of it. But many people in the Navy, in fact, it was kind of a tradition that if someone out there in the field had risen to a position of great authority and responsibility, by definition, they're smart, and by definition, they have good judgment. So there's no need to micromanage them by telling them what you want them to do. You inform them of the situation and let them come up with the means by which to execute an order. And there's some logic to that. I think in management, it's a good idea to allow your subordinates to be creative. The part that really made it bad was they didn't ask him to then report what the decisions were that he had made. They assumed that their warning had caused him to begin aerial reconnaissance, to look for possible threats that would be coming to the Hawaiian Islands. And they continued to assume that right up until December 7th, that he had put out planes and was looking. He had not. So each side lived in ignorance of the other's intent.
You have another chilling story that relates very specifically to that. Tell us the story about, was it the afternoon of the attack? A communication, a phone call from who to who, and what was the conversation?
The transcript of this phone call, which I found in the Naval History and Heritage Command archives at the Navy Yard in Washington, actually brought me close, I think, to tears, because it's so painful to read this transcript. It occurred at Washington time, I think it was slightly after midnight into December 8th. The caller was Harold Stark, again, the chief of naval operations, and he was calling Hawaii for more details about what had happened. This was an age when communications were much more raw than they are today. There were no instant television pictures or satellite images. They were having a hard time in Washington figuring out exactly the extent of the damage. Kimmel had sent a message with a report that was pretty brutal, talking about the numbers of his ships that had been damaged. But Stark still wanted more information, and I think the point of his phone call was he was beginning to realize that what he thought had been going on out in Hawaii was not going on. So he called and reached an admiral named Block, B-L-O-C-H, and he asked repeatedly.
Who was at Pearl?
He was at Pearl, yes. He asked repeatedly, were the planes out? And Block kept saying, I don't know, you have to ask Kimmel. And he kept asking, what sectors were they in? Did we catch them before they got here? And Block finally says, no, they weren't out. You're going to be disappointed in the answers. They caught us flat-footed, which was the last word of the transcript.
One of the things, you know, it's interesting. You allude to it. And it's sort of a little subtextual theme throughout the book. But it's startling to think about where we've come in terms of communication and in terms of surveillance. It's really kind of hard for us in an age of satellite surveillance to understand how a Japanese fleet could go undetected in the Pacific Ocean in 1941. The world has changed in the most dramatic way since then. Yeah,
absolutely. That's why I don't think we could have a Pearl Harbor today, at least in a grand military sense of vast numbers of ships and troops moving without being detected. Satellites have rendered all of that virtually impossible. But in 1941, the Japanese were able to assemble this attack fleet in an extremely remote corner of Japan and sail for 12 days across 3,150 miles without being seen. That said, they expected to be seen, not by satellites, but they just thought they would bump into a commercial ship or an American warship or an American reconnaissance plane. There was great fatalism on board those 30 Japanese ships about the likelihood of success. So we don't appreciate today how it was actually, in a way, easier to move from Japan to Hawaii and not be seen. But even so, then they thought it was almost impossible to do that.
I want to back up just for a minute, because there's another aspect of lack of preparation that I thought was fascinating in your book. The general who was in charge of Army forces at Pearl was
Walter C. Short.
Walter Short got a message about the war warning, you tell us, and he assumed that it was a message alerting him that the Japanese population of Hawaii, which was extensive, I think you tell us 30-plus thousand Japanese living on Oahu at that point?
There were actually more people of Japanese descent in Hawaii than any other ethnic group, racial group, more than the native Hawaiians, more than whites, more than Filipinos. There were thousands of Japanese Americans, both first and second generation, and they had come initially to work in the sugar cane fields and the pineapple fields.
So he had airplanes at his disposal, too, the Army Air Corps, and presumably could have decided to alert them to expand their surveillance. Instead, he received the message as a message to be alert to sabotage, and he deployed defensive forces on the island, right?
He, after the war warning of November 27th, if you were a resident of Honolulu, you noticed something on November 28th. You noticed that soldiers were now guarding commercial radio stations, bridges, waterworks, and they were there because of this real feeling that Short and many others had that the native Japanese on the island were going to rise up and blow up the infrastructure of Hawaii and perhaps attack the fleet. Now, the FBI on Hawaii, the special agent in charge, never understood, in effect, what Short was talking about. He never detected any evidence that the population was anything but loyal. And in fact, no sabotage occurred either before the attack or after.
Another missed opportunity to send planes out to on reconnaissance missions. Tell you what, let's take a break. I want to talk about this from the Japanese point of view, because you do a very vivid job of describing that to us as well. We're talking to Steve Toomey. His new book is Countdown to Pearl Harbor. You're listening to Two-Way Street. We'll be back after a message. If you're just joining us, my guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Steve Toomey. His book, Countdown to Pearl Harbor, The 12 Days to the Attack, was released in paperback last month. Steve, tell us about, I think I'm pronouncing it right, Hidekapu Bay.
Hidekapu,
is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes, that's a very good pronunciation.
Okay.
Hidekapu Bay is in an island chain at the far northern end of the main Japanese islands, and it is where the Japanese attack fleet assembled prior to departure, and they picked it because, particularly in late November, it's a very desolate, almost unpopulated place. They didn't want their own people, of course, to know of the existence of this fleet, because lips might not be sealed, and the word could still reach the American embassy in Tokyo if people were careless, that there was this large fleet assembled in this odd place. So it was only there, by the way, that the 16,000 or so enlisted men aboard these ships and the secondary officers found out not only where they were going to be going, but who their enemy was. Many of them thought they were about to go attack the British down in Singapore. And of course, when they turned north and went to this remote bay, they realized the British were not going to be the target. And then when they were told that Hawaii was the target, they often felt that they were spending their last hours in Japan.
The American Navy had at one point looked at Hidekapu Bay as a possible place to keep some of its ships, and decided it was completely inhospitable for warships.
Yes, our intelligence regarded it as such a difficult place to anchor a ship because of the weather, because of the currents, that it would not prove to be a useful place for any Navy to put its ships. That's how remote and sort of off-putting it was, which was exactly the point. The Japanese chose it because it seemed so unlikely.
You introduced to us, as we start learning about the Japanese movements in the weeks before Pearl, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, a famous name in history.
Very famous.
But you have such a vivid description of him. He was known as 80 Sen. He was a tiny little man, you tell us. Why was he called 80 Sen?
He had, as many Japanese officers of high rank in 1941 had fought in the war of 1904-05 against the Russians, a war Japan won against all, if you normally weigh the size and economic power of countries, you wouldn't have thought Japan could win that war. But in that war, he lost a couple of fingers aboard a ship. And the geishas of Japan would charge you by the finger for manicures or to have your nails done. And since he only had eight and it was 10 sen a finger, he was Mr. 80 Sen.
We should point out that despite his diminutive stature, American intelligence, you tell us, was very, very aware of him. You quote at one point a report that says, in any war with us, he may be expected to adopt a bold and positive course of action. And it was Yamamoto, I think, who said, we have to launch a surprise attack on the United States before any declaration of war, because if we don't, they have the ability to crush us.
That's right. In theory, he opposed war with the United States because he knew the disparities in economic power. But Japan at that time was kind of on a crazy streak with visions of empire on a grand scale. And they were already planning a massive operation into the Southwest Pacific. I think most of us think of Pearl Harbor as being the central focus of that day. It really wasn't. Japan invaded or attacked multiple other places that day.
In part because the Japanese were shocked that Pearl Harbor was chock full of American targets. They never expected the American fleet would all be there when they arrived, right?
That's right. One of the objections to the attack that Yamamoto had to overcome was, again, in this age before satellites, they had no way of knowing as they set sail whether their target was going to be where they hoped it was going to be. They only learned that en route. But Yamamoto had insisted that if they were going to conduct these vast operations to the Southwest, they had to do this in order to neutralize the only force in the Pacific with the power and capability of interfering with their plans. He won that argument over tremendous objections regarding the distance and the difficulty.
Now, on the other side, the Americans, too, were convinced that the Japanese had their eyes on those other islands, the Philippines and the other islands distant from Pearl Harbor, which is yet another reason why more effective measures were taken to prevent an attack at Pearl, right?
Yes. One of the things I think people would be surprised to know is that war was not the surprise of December 7th. We fully anticipated that a war was about to break out, but we thought it was going to break out in these distant locations about which we had more intelligence. There had been reports of Japanese ships leaving from ports on China's coast, which they occupied at the time. So we were well aware of this big movement to the Southwest. But Pearl Harbor just never entered into the mind, certainly of Admiral Kimmel, as their likely destination as well.
Because we didn't think Pearl was going to be the target, there was one fortuitous decision made that played a huge role later in the war. The USS Enterprise was ordered to leave Pearl to steam toward where they expected the action to be.
Yeah. Yes. Actually, there were two aircraft carriers. The Enterprise was one. The Lexington is another that were based at Pearl Harbor. Neither was there on December 7th, and that is attributable mostly to just good fortune. Both of them were, at that moment, acting sort of as FedEx delivery trucks. They were transporting Marine fighter planes to the American outposts of Wake and Midway Islands, which were thousands of miles to the west, to bolster the defenses of those islands, which were much more in the path of possible Japanese aggression. And so it was very lucky that those two carriers were not there. One of Japan's great disappointments on December 7th was that they were not, because they intended to hit them as well as hit the battleships there. Just as a side note, it's important. It wasn't only just luck. It changed the course of the war because the Enterprise was one of the aircraft carriers that subsequently sank four Japanese aircraft carriers at the Battle of Midway 6 months later.
The Japanese stealth operation was remarkable. What were some of the measures they took to avoid, both while they were in harbor and then as they steamed toward Pearl, carrying the war planes that were going to make the attack?
They did all kinds of things that might strike us as OCD. No garbage could be thrown overboard from a ship, the fear being that if a piece of identifying paper somehow washed ashore, someone could pick it up, realize the ships had been there, and word would start to spread. So garbage was taken ashore before they left and burned from every ship. en route, they had actually sometimes on some ships sealed off the telegraph keys on their radios so that no one could accidentally bump a key, which would send a random signal into the air that an American eavesdropper might hear. Those ships were absolutely silent as they went across the Pacific. And silent, by that I mean they radioed no one. They didn't talk by radio to anyone. They talked to each other only by blinker light and signal flag, all to avoid emanations from the fleet that could be picked up by American listeners. And they knew the Americans were listening. And as I mentioned, the people on board those ships didn't really know where they were going until the last minute.
All right, so they're heading toward Pearl. Meanwhile, negotiations are going on between the Japanese and Americans to try to avert war. In the final days of November, they seem to break down almost entirely. We'll allow people who are listening to the show should read about all that because it's fascinating. But there is one aspect of that that I do want to address, and that's the ambassador, the Japanese ambassador to the United States, who was engaged in it, Nomura.
Admiral Nomura. He was all ex-Navy.
He received, he himself, he certainly didn't want war either.
I don't think he did at all, and he was very afraid that that's what was coming.
And as he negotiated with the Americans over issues like getting Japan to pull out of China and other details that, again, people can read in your book, as November came to an end and these negotiations were really heading nowhere, there were some troubling signs for him, too. For instance, he was told at one point to stall, right?
Yes, he was getting conflicting orders from Tokyo. For much of the summer, it was hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, because we got to get this together, or in a memorable phrase, something is going to happen. They told him that. And then towards the end of November, they reversed entirely, and they basically told him, here's what you can tell the Americans to stall them.
Yeah, the Japanese were expected to respond to a list of demands
That's right.
the Americans had given them.
The chief negotiator for the United States, the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, had long ago lost patience with the Japanese, didn't think they were bargaining in good faith, didn't think they would compromise. And toward the end of November, he gave them a list of points that he wanted them to endorse. Otherwise, there was no point in going forward, such as, in my words, don't attack other countries. Do you accept that? And they were waiting through the end of November and first week of December for the Japanese to reply to that. And they did. And they did on December 7th, basically, with a message that never really declared war, but indicated that they weren't satisfied.
And in those days leading up to the 7th, when Nomura is told stall, it's clear to him why he's stalling. There was no question the Japanese attack at that point was going to take place.
He knew they were going to do something.
He
didn't know Pearl Harbor was the objective. It was clear from months earlier that they were intent on heading towards the Southwest Pacific. He's really a kind of a tragic character because at one point, I think he realized he was just a front. He was being used, and he tried to quit. He asked to be relieved, and Tokyo told him, no, no, stay where you are. But he also tried to freelance a little bit. He would tell things to Hull that he hadn't been authorized to say, and he would not tell Tokyo things that Hull had said that he thought might upset Tokyo. So he wasn't a professional diplomat, but he clearly had been through war in the past and knew that this was going to be very bad.
What was magic?
Magic is the word used to sort of generically describe the material we were getting from a machine called Purple. And that was, those were the results of intercepted Japanese diplomatic codes. I think one of the great stories of Pearl Harbor is that the United States had crafted a duplicate of the Japanese coding machine that was used to send messages from Tokyo to Washington. And it's remarkable because they had no blueprints. They had no photos. They had no sources. They imagined how the Japanese system must be working. And for about a year, we were reading almost all the exchanges between Tokyo and Nomura. And the obvious question would be, well, how come that didn't stop World War II? And the answer is the foreign ministry never included military details, and there'd be no reason for it to do so. And I'm not even sure the foreign ministry knew of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
So in some ways, relying on those communications, and you point this out, was misleading because it didn't include information about troop movements, carrier
right.
movements, battleship movements. It lulled the Americans into a somewhat false sense of security.
Yes, the probably the smartest person in regard to the Japanese in the Navy was a man named Arthur McCollum, who was in intelligence. And he once warned people that, you know, this isn't all they're saying to each other, these diplomatic codes that we're reading. You're not reading the principal naval codes and the principal army codes. And he was memorably told, oh, Mac, we're reading the mail. And yes, but not all of it. And that was the problem. I don't think it can be said that having that absolutely lulled them into thinking nothing could happen. I do think it gave them a sense of security that at that level they shouldn't have had.
There was another way in which the U.S. Forces were trying to keep track of the Japanese, and it was a little more – talk to us about the other way in which they were listening to the Japanese.
Far more important way was listening to the Navy, the Japanese Navy, talk to itself, which all navies were doing on the radio. And there was a little outpost on the east coast of Hawaii – in which 30 or so Navy enlisted men sat there all day with headphones on, listening to the Japanese Morse code that they could pick up. It would be ship to ship, ship to shore. We wouldn't know what they were saying because we hadn't broken that code. But when a ship is sending a message to another ship, you have to have the address of who it's supposed to go to and who it's from, just so that you can understand this message is meant from you and who's talking to you. And we could identify what were called those call signs. And if you listen long enough, you can figure out who's who, where they are, and where they might be going. Well, not so much where they were going, but where they were. And so every day we were gathering this information, and it was our principal way of trying to figure out what they were doing. And it did yield military information. It wasn't at all 100% certain, because the enemy would know that you're listening, and they would try to fool you, often just by saying nothing.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about that is that there was another important clue that something was going to happen that related to those communications. The Japanese had a very specific pattern by which they changed the call signs right. for the ships, right?
Yes.
They typically did it every 6 months.
Yes.
So November 1st was a six-month moment to change the call signs, and they did, correct?
They did. Right on schedule, they switched all of those addresses. And that requires you to start back at ground zero again.
Yeah, because you don't know what ship is being referred
exactly.
to. But then something really crucial
right.
happened.
At 4:30 a.m. Hawaiian time on the 30th of November, we understood, we realized they had changed all their call signals again. Only 30 days after they had done it the last time, they had never done that before. And in Hawaii, that was recognized as something extremely significant, that clearly the Japanese were concerned that we were listening to their radio communications, figuring out their movements, and that something big was coming. Because once again, they had to start at ground zero, or zero, to reassemble new addresses. So something was clearly brewing.
Almost simultaneously, we lost track of what? Four Japanese aircraft carriers? They disappeared. We didn't know where they had gone.
This was one of the, another very sad moment in the legacy of Pearl Harbor is that Admiral Kimmel, the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet, was told on December 2nd, that radio intelligence could not now identify or pinpoint the location of four of Japan's aircraft carriers. They had 10, so that's 4 out of 10. And Kimmel amusingly said to his intelligence officer, "Do you mean they could be coming around Diamond Head?" Which, of course, is the most famous, iconic geographical feature on Oahu. His intelligence officer thought he was kidding. He was just poking him. Kimmel was poking the intelligence officer for not knowing where the ships were. But I've always thought that question alone signifies that Kimmel was starting to get a little worried about, we don't quite know what they're doing out there.
Another moment when another moment that Kimmel might later have reflected upon as he thought back on the mistakes he made. We have to take another break, but when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Steve Toomey. His book is Countdown to Pearl Harbor. This is Two-Way Street. We're talking to Steve Toomey about Countdown to Pearl Harbor. One of the great mistakes that the Americans made was their stereotypical notions of the inferiority of the Japanese, yes?
It's remarkable how the press during the summer and fall of 1941, the American press, would write really disparaging and condescending articles about the military capabilities of the Japanese. We really did think of them as kind of a strange and funny little people. And I don't think we were alone. I think Western countries, as a rule, had low opinions of Japanese military ability. They weren't technologically proficient. They could only develop weapons by copying Western versions. They weren't mechanically implying.
These were the stereotypical. This wasn't true. This was
what
was being said.
I certainly don't want to convey the impression that I believe this.
Yeah.
Quite the reverse.
Okay.
They were quite competent at many of these things. And even though there were voices in the Navy Department that tried to argue back, saying, no, they're quite proficient at doing this, the common wisdom was so common that it didn't really sink in. No one regarded Japan's ability when it came to aviation is particularly high. And there were even things written about how physiologically
they were too short to fly the plane.
Their eyes were wrong.
They had inner ear defects that would confuse them flying an airplane. Their balance was off, right?
It's extraordinary. I referred earlier to this officer, Arthur McCollum, in Naval Intelligence. Arthur had been born in Japan, and he knew the Japanese, and it drove him crazy to hear these stories about how allegedly Japanese babies were carried on the backs of their big sisters and bounced around as they're going through their villages of Japan, and it threw their sense of balance off, and that's what made them lousy pilots. This drove Arthur crazy. But he couldn't counteract this perception. And if I might, the supreme example, I think, of this condescension towards the Japanese is that in the hours after the attack, the rumor on Congress, on Capitol Hill, was that, oh, well, the Germans had helped the Japanese plan the attack, and they may have even been flying some of the airplanes. In other words, only white people could have done this, not these funny little people from Asia.
And if we look at the propaganda, even before there was a heavy propaganda effort launched at the Japanese, those stereotypes filled our newsreels and magazine article. I mean, it must have made Sunday, December 7th here in the States a day in which people walked around with their mouths open because they couldn't imagine the Japanese capable of this sort of thing.
On On the East Coast that day, there were a group of journalists and government officials having a mid-Sunday afternoon dinner at a private home outside New York City, and the phone rang, and the word came to the group that there had been an attack by the Japanese on Pearl Harbor. And the man, regarded as the most experienced and worldly and savvy of those at the dinner table, told the others, "Oh, it's a hoax." And they all agreed with that. It was simply beyond their comprehension that Japan could have pulled off something like this. So, yes, that was an extreme element, a major element of the shock was not only that we had been attacked, but who had done it.
As we come to a conclusion, let's talk just a little bit about one of the great characters, of the many vivid characters that you tell us about in your book, Billy Outerbridge.
Bill Outerbridge was, I think he was a lieutenant at that time in the Navy, and I think you might say he was a bit of a malcontent. He was the second in command of a destroyer and really disliked his captain, thought his captain was a fool. And so Bill had asked for a transfer to anything. He wanted either shore duty or his own ship. And a few days before what would be the day of the attack, he was granted his wish and given command of his own destroyer. He was thrilled. He took command of that destroyer on December 5th in the harbor at Pearl Harbor. And on December 6th, he went out on his first patrol. This was the first ship he had ever commanded.
It was something of an old hulk, you tell us.
It was born during World War I. It entered the water in 1918. And his mission on the 6th was to patrol the entrance of the harbor, not because necessarily they thought they were about to be attacked, but because times were tense. And so this destroyer, the name of which is the Ward, was patrolling back and forth. And in the early morning, just after first light on December 7th, Outerbridge was asleep behind the bridge, and he was told, "Captain, come to the bridge." And I think in one of the nicest touches of the war, what did he put on? He put on a kimono to go to the bridge, and he and his men could see there was an object in the water, and they recognized it immediately as a submarine that was not American. Now, here's a guy on his first day as captain of his first ship, and he knew that by firing on this, he was going to end the peace with Japan, and he didn't hesitate. They fired on it, and they sank it, and his warning to Pearl Harbor that I have attacked and fired upon a submarine was an hour before the planes arrived overhead, yet there was no response that mattered to his report.
To bring us full circle, it was his report of sinking the submarine was the first thing that husband Kimmel saw that led him to understand Pearl Harbor was under attack.
That's why his phone had rung that morning. He was taking a report about the actions of this particular destroyer and this particular captain. And before he could do much about that or take it more seriously, I should say, he was summoned outside and the planes were overhead.
Steve Toomey, your book, Countdown to Pearl Harbor, The 12 Days to the Attack, is a gripping read. And I'm really glad you could be here with us today to talk about it. We're going to post more information about your book on the website for Two Way Street, gpb.org/TWS. Steve, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Before we leave you, I wanted to tell you that next week we'll present the first of our two special holiday shows. On next week's show, we'll be visited by Christian Bush, the singer-songwriter who's a partner with Jennifer Nettles in Sugarland and who every year comes in to play for us the new Christmas songs he's written. That's next week on Two Way Street with Christian Bush. Our senior producer is Jenny Amond. Olivia Rheingold is our associate producer. Tyler Morris is our engineer. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. I hope to see you again next week for another Two Way Street.